Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios here in Beijing. I'm Jeremy Goldkorn, hosting today without Kaiser, who is in Tianjin hobnobbing with the global elite at the World Economic Forum.
I would be amazed if he would deign to sit with the likes of us when he comes back.
Us plebeians. And that voice you just heard there was Seneca regular Will Moss, PR, what do we call you?
Practitioner.
Practitioner extraordinaire and regular Seneca guest. Welcome, Will.
Thank you.
We have a new guest on Seneca tonight. I'm very, very happy to welcome Jonathan Landreth.
Hi, Jeremy.
Jonathan Landreth has a history dating back. We first met, in fact, in the offices of Beijing Scene
Indeed.
In 1997.
That's right.
So we have a very long history in the media in Beijing, and we had some interesting experiences at that particular organization. But Jonathan, since then, came back to China when?
I've been back a couple of times, but this recent tour began in October 1st, 2004.
October 1st, 2004. And since then, most of what you've been covering has been the movie business, right?
Indeed. I set up the bureau for The Hollywood Reporter, the industry newspaper based in Los Angeles. And 6 years on, after the crash in the advertising industry in the States, decided to go freelance. And as the movie industry grew up here, so did mainstream U.S. publications' interests in it. And so I've been writing for a host of different newspapers about how Hollywood and China are interacting.
And basically, you're the only foreign correspondent in Beijing at the moment who has focused on this industry, right?
I've done it alongside some esteemed colleagues like Clifford Coonan, who writes for Variety periodically about Chinese film industry. But I'm the only one who's focused almost exclusively on film.
Because Clifford writes other stuff, politics and current events.
And very well.
Okay. So before we get into the meat of today's topic, which is obviously the movie business, Hollywood, China, Hollywood meets China, and whatever mutant creature bastard will come out of that strange encounter. Before we get into that, let's just have a quick run through what's going on in China in the last week or so. There's been something very strange going on. Heir presumptive to Hu Jintao, Xi Jinping, has vanished. What has been going on? Can either of you explain the situation?
Certainly not. His name did appear in the state press, however, saying that he'd offered condolences to a family, but there was no direct quote.
Let's just set the scene. So what's happened? There's been basically a week in which Xi Jinping was supposed to have met Hillary Clinton and who else?
Lee Hsien Loong, the Prime Minister of Singapore, and also was it the Danish or Dutch?
The Danish Foreign Minister.
And these meetings were canceled without explanation?
All three. Those meetings were in fairly close succession, and they were all canceled. And Xi Jinping has been neither seen nor heard from in the intervening period and is one of the highest profile members of the leadership. That seems to have struck everybody as a bit odd. So it's been a major focus of the foreign media and the rumor mill for the last week.
And the Chinese rumor mill has been
ballistic.
All kinds of things. So the Chinese rumor mill, people have been saying he's got a backache or back pain because of swimming, that there was an assassination attempt.
Some
what
truly
else has there
outlandish
been?
Stuff boiled up. A lot of health rumors.
He had a stroke. Willie Lam of the SCMP, who always claims to have good sources in Zhongnanhai, says he's had a stroke. What
there
else?
Was a stroke, the heart attack, that he was in an arranged car accident that was part of an assassination attempt.
Not a Ferrari, though.
Nobody said he was driving a Ferrari.
So would either of you gentlemen care to offer an explanation for what is going on?
I should point out that he's not the only one missing this week, that apparently He Guoqiang, the state council, the head of the disciplinary committee in the standing committee, has also not been seen, and people in the rumor mill are linking their disappearances.
And if you've been following the increasingly frustrated tweets from the foreign media community, particularly as they attend the Ministry of Foreign Affairs scheduled press conferences, you'll see that nobody in an official spokesmanship position in the government seems to be willing to address the issue at all. They've been asked repeatedly, where is C, what's going on, and no explanation.
And they say basically, we have no information.
We have no information.
And don't ask this question.
Yeah, stop asking us.
Yeah.
We don't know, damn it.
So what's going on?
Well, who knows?
It also, I suppose, should be pointed out that it's not the first time that, a Chinese leader of his presumptive standing has disappeared. Former Premier Li Peng disappeared for 7 weeks in 1993, I believe it was.
But it turned out he had, in fact, been ill.
Indeed. So if history is any guide,
Xi Jinping's probably got a cold, at least.
It's an issue, of course, because as everybody in the orbit of Seneca knows, the 18th Party Congress is just around the corner, ostensibly for sometime next month if it stays on the presumed track. And
this is supposed to be the event that coronates, that crowns Xi Jinping as the new
president.
The new guy.
The timing is rattling everybody's cage a little bit, and that's one reason why the rumor mill has, I think, gone into hyperdrive. And this is a classic communications lesson. The normal approach, say, in the United States of America, not to hold them up as an example of diplomatic communication, but would be to say, here's what's going on, and here's some information for you to curb the speculation. Here there has been nothing. There's been no information. There's been no official statement. There is a void, and into that void has marched the phenomenally efficient and colorful Chinese rumor machinery. So,
from all of which we can conclude that, number one, there's some really weird shit going down in Zhongnanhai, number one. And number two, this government has not moved on from their Stalinist roots, and they have no clue how to communicate in the 21st century.
It's a real throwback situation. I think it was Evan Osnos who invoked the latter generation Soviet leaders, Andropov and Chernenko, who sort of got ill and died and and their fates were sort of shrouded in mystery by the party. And this really is a bit of sort of throwback management. This guy is the presumptive president of China, globally interconnected quasi-superpower, and so people are understandably curious about what's going on with him.
And I guess that, takeaway point number three maybe is that, how to put it properly, a lot of people are holding up the Chinese government as some kind of model to follow that may, work for Africa or even the rest of the world, the country that managed to thrive during the global financial crisis. But what this tells us really is that this bunch of clowns don't have a model that anybody could possibly want to imitate, because this is absurd.
It is, if nothing else, a powerful reminder of the opacity of the machinery.
In fact, that they run their affairs like a mafia.
Another perspective, I was sitting around at lunch yesterday, sort of cloistered Baotian in a Chinese restaurant with a visiting Hollywood executive and his Chinese staff. And the Chinese staff all said, well, hey, at least it's a lot more exciting here.
Yeah.
Back in America, you'd be completely bombarded with Obama and Romney on television 24/7, and you still don't know what to think.
I was there last week. I was in New York last week, and I was saturated in convention coverage, and I can assure you it's not a good place to be. It's not a good place to be. But we know that the last year or so, there's been a real preoccupation with rumors on the internet, rumors on Weibo, and probably it'll be rumors on Weixin, WeChat next, because that is the up-and-coming platform, no doubt the up-and-coming platform for rumors. The lesson is, if you want to stop the rumors, you better have some information. If you don't, there's no way to stop the rumors.
Yeah. Okay, one other kind of China soft power total clusterfuck I'd like to quickly address is in the United States of America, in the great state of Colorado, there is a city named Corvallis, and a Taiwanese-American... Oregon, Colorado, full of people in North Face gear doing healthy things. Difficult to tell them apart.
Do you want to take it again?
In the great state of Oregon, in a little town named Corvallis, a Taiwanese-American proprietor of a building painted a mural on the building that showed scenes of Tibetans self-immolating and other imagery that was not consistent with the Chinese government's
police
view of itself.
Chinese police
beating people up or something.
Or beating,
Did you follow this? What happened after this mural? What's been the news?
The Chinese sent, first a written letter to the city government of Corvallis, followed by a visit from two diplomats from the consulate in San Francisco, which would be the nearest consulate, to the city government to urge the city government of Corvallis to intervene and have the rumor, so you can see where my mind is, have the mural removed because it was offensive and hurting the feelings of the Chinese people.
To which the city officials said...
Under the Constitution of the United States of America, it is not within our powers to do this. So sent them away unhappy.
Yeah. This is a great story. I mean, this really is yet another illustration of some of the problems one faces in China when, people who are supposed to be diplomats don't have the savvy to realize that by doing that, they have ensured global media coverage.
We call it PRing the problem.
PRing the problem. Is that what?
It's PRing the problem. Taking something that you want to cover up and that otherwise people probably wouldn't see and turning it into a huge thing.
So basically, let's look at the equivalent if the American State Department did a similar thing. What would basically be the equivalent would be the consul in Shanghai going to Suzhou to talk to a small business owner to remove an anti-American mural. That would be the equivalent.
Probably, yes.
Right. Okay. Full stop. Period. Soft power. Say no more. Let's move on to the next subject and the meat of today's podcast.
Can I please just add one thing before we get
into
it?
Not parrot. Comma. Semicolon.
Recognizing that they may have been obligated for reasons I don't understand, the diplomats, to go and do this, China sees the U.S. as a rival. And one of the keys to overcoming or dealing with a rival is to understand them. What struck me about this event is that on some level it betrays a total lack of understanding.
This is the problem with the government in China and the Communist Party, is that too much of their time is spent in meetings with themselves. And I don't want to use the loaded term brainwashed, but too much time is spent learning what the orthodoxies of China are, and not enough time is spent learning what the orthodoxies of certain other countries are, I think, right? I mean, that's the problem. They're not actually learning what Americans think.
Or if they are, they're not acting on it in any
discernible way. No, because they can't, possibly, because they're impotent.
Now we can continue.
All right. So Xi Jinping, the guy who's missing now, but we still assume at the moment is going to be the next leader of China, he went to America earlier this year. When was that?
In February, he paid a sort of Valentine's Day visit to Hollywood, in fact.
He paid a Valentine's Day visit to the Midwest, to Hollywood. He did the right things. Everybody was impressed with the visit. What did he do in Hollywood, Jonathan?
Whilst in Hollywood, he stood with Vice President Joe Biden and Jeffrey Katzenberg, the CEO of DreamWorks Animation, one of the biggest and most powerful executives in the film business the world over. And presided over the announcement by Biden and the Motion Picture Association of the U.S.-China film deal. That deal increased the number of films from Hollywood allowed to be imported into China every year from around 20 each year
It's been 20 for how many years?
It's been 20 since China acceded to the WTO. So over 10 years.
So since 2001.
2001. Indeed, there are many more films imported each year. It is only those 20 that for that period since 2001 were allowed to recoup part of the box office back to the copyright holder, the Hollywood studios for the most part. Now, under this new deal, which was hard fought by the U.S. Trade Representative at the World Trade Organization in Geneva, 14 more 3D and IMAX pictures, or rather large format pictures, will be allowed into Hollywood, into China each year on a revenue sharing basis. So now you can bring another Avatar like film in if it's 3D or IMAX and recoup a greater portion of the box office, whereas before you could only get around about 15% of the gross ticket sales. Now you can get as much as 25%. So
it should be good for Hollywood if Hollywood is prepared to make 3D and large format pictures?
Hollywood is absolutely prepared to and is doing so at a rapid clip.
And will those pictures sell in China?
They're doing incredibly well already. If you look at the box office in China in the first half of this year, Titanic 3D, a 17-year-old film reformatted in 3D, grossed more than any other film.
Without the tits, though.
Indeed, it was censored. And Mr. Cameron, who has also been doing a lot of business here in China lately, bringing his camera technology to China to sell that on to Chinese film producers, says as a director he's not happy about censorship, but as a businessman he's perfectly prepared to help Chinese filmmakers use cutting-edge technology.
So that's one thing that came out of Xi Jinping's visit to the United States was potentially, and I'm going to say potentially because it's not it would not be a surprise if the allotted quota didn't quite make it through if one looks at the past.
Well, it's already begun to. I mean, more films indeed have been allowed in. The downside to that is that after the first quarter the first half produced a box office imbalance as far as the party and the state administration of radio, film, and television are concerned. You know, historically, Chinese films have always made at least 50% of the box office. It's always been allowed that imports would come in, but not at too great a rate and not too many of them. And Chinese films always did better. And that was because they were limited in number and they were limited as to when they were allowed to be released, not during the holiday periods when more people go to movies. So after the first half, you had Hollywood films making 65% of the box office. Huge, huge imbalance.
You wrote this China Economic Quarterly article, and you had a table illustrating this.
Indeed.
We should, in fact, refer to that China Economic Quarterly article, which was in some ways the inspiration for this podcast Jonathan wrote.
It's a very interesting table.
You should subscribe to the China Economic Quarterly to read it. It's very worthwhile.
The top seven films were all American, and eight of the top ten.
That's correct. So Titanic 3D, a 17-year-old film, which for 13 years, in fact, had been China's highest grossing film, comes back. So it's got a base audience. It's got a core fan base among a certain number of Chinese of a certain age. They come back. They're now also fascinated by 3D. There has been no massively successful 3D Chinese film until last year. And this 17-year-old film cleaned up at the box office. Just remarkable.
So what are these Hollywood people going to do when they try to bring in they've got a film going and it's doing really well in China, like Avatar was, and suddenly, like during Avatar, I think it was the Confucius film came out towards the end of Avatar's run, and suddenly Avatar got cut from a bunch of major theaters, and the Confucius film,
which was allegedly wretched, I never saw it.
It's appalling. I mean, you know, there's nothing not appalling about anything connected with that film. And Avatar, bye-bye, Avatar, hello, Kongzi, hello, Confucius. What are, you know, Katzenberg et al. Going to make of this when this happens next year or this year?
As it inevitably will.
They're going to be fucked over, shafted. Well, what are they going to do?
Indeed.
Are they prepared? Do they know they're going to be shafted?
It's already happened. It sort of seems to be a cost of doing business. I mean, after that imbalance in the first half where 65% of the box office was earned by Hollywood Pictures, the State Administration of Radio, Film, and Television and the Film Bureau basically imposed a blackout. Now, that's happened before, but this one was a longer than normal blackout, which meant that no imported films were allowed in. Just at the moment that Huayi Brothers, one of the largest independent film studios based here in Beijing, long the producer of movies by director Feng Xiaogang, most recently Aftershock, the big Tangshan earthquake film of a couple of years ago, his company, Huayi Brothers, or not his company, but the company that's backed him, Huayi Brothers, released Painted Skin 2 in 3D, and it cleaned up at the box office and now was catapulted because of the greater number of people going to the movies and interested in 3D to the fourth highest grossing film of all time in China behind three major Hollywood blockbusters. But it did so with no competition from the outside.
Didn't they also consolidate the launch dates or the release dates of a bunch of big Hollywood blockbusters?
So just after that blackout that ended, as the summer did, both The Amazing Spider-Man and The Dark Knight Rises were essentially forced to be released, and the release dates are all controlled by the state, forced to be released in head-to-head competition with one another, whereas in the past they would have tended to be sort of, you know, staggered, which was to the benefit of exhibitors, theater owners, who could basically earn more money if they had one big blockbuster at a time. Now, there is actual market competition, but it's completely controlled in terms of when it happens.
Can we back up a little bit?
Yes.
It might be worth, John, then you tell us a little bit about why the film industry here is so controlled and what the role of the China Film Corporation is in managing the industry here and exerting that control on behalf of the government.
Sure, sure. I mean, you have to think back. Film is a medium which
yeah,
for a long time...
Yeah, let's think back and let's go big picture. Let's go satellite picture.
Absolutely. I mean, film in China, much as it was in the former Soviet Union, was not a commercial enterprise. It was a means to get out a message. It remains so to some degree. It has commercialized greatly in the years that I've covered it for the last 8 years. You know,
anybody who's watched the two big party epics that came out in the last few years, you know, will observe that the role of film as a propaganda mechanism is not disappeared completely.
Not at all. I mean, Jiang Guodai, that's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
What was that called? The founding
of the Republic.
The founding of the...
Great Enterprise or the founding of the Republic.
The founding of a nation or the founding of a republic? And then there was Jiang Dang.
Yes,
the founding of the party. Yeah. Which was somewhat less.
Now, both of those films, mind you, were at least co-directed by Han Sanping, who is the chairman of the China Film Group. And the China Film Group is the largest state-run studio. It is the 800-pound gorilla in the film industry. Its sister companies control the import of Hollywood films. They control most of the distribution of those films, which brings me back to another important point, but remind me to bring it up. We'll go big picture first. These state studios, the China Film Group just being the largest of them, for years just produced films which were on message with the party's message of the moment, whatever that might be. These two films came out a couple of years ago. Again, were not put up in competition against Hollywood Pictures. They did phenomenally well at the box office. They had, you know, star-studded casts with every last Chinese film star you can name.
Sort of ridiculous cameos.
In cameos, it's alleged that none of them was paid for their roles.
It's also alleged that the box office figures were a little bit goosed for those movies, that, you know, sort of people were being bussed in.
That goes on all the time, as far as we know. I mean, you have to think back again, looking back. Film was a medium that was not a commercial enterprise. It was a medium to deliver the message. So if you look back to, you know, 20 years ago or longer, just after the Cultural Revolution, when the first generation of directors came out of the Beijing Film Academy, Zhang Yimou, Tian Zhuangzhuang, Chen Kaige, you know, their independent films were getting out of China through the Hong Kong International Film Festival and then to theaters mostly in California and Europe. But those first filmmakers were seeing phenomenal admissions, meaning that a heck of a number of people in China, more so than today, were going to the theater. But the ticket price was, you know, 5 yuan. Today, a ticket price to an IMAX 3D movie can go as high as 180 yuan.
It's ludicrous. Speaking as somebody who likes to go to the movies, like, it is astounding how much a ticket for an IMAX or a 3D film costs in this town now. I mean, the cinemas are nice these days, which is great. But the tickets are like, you can't do dinner in a movie. You can just do a movie. You can't afford dinner afterwards.
Well, Peter Lohr, who long ran the Creative Artists Agency here in China, one of the largest talent agencies in Hollywood and the world.
And previously was the most successful foreign movie producer operating
indeed,
in China, right?
Indeed, absolutely. His Imar films produced some of the greatest independent films, some of the films that got me interested in the Chinese film business.
The 1990s.
Yeah.
Peter
Long has referred to, as have others, but it was he from whom I first heard the phrase, movies are a white-collar date in China, and that remains true. It does remain true despite the size of the market growing. And you have to think, the box office last year jumped 30%. It has jumped at least 25% 7 years in a row. It has doubled since 2009 to $2.1 billion gross in 2011. That is still only a fraction of the size of the North American box office, which is $10 billion plus.
So these numbers sound great, but can I ask you again, do the Hollywood people know how they're going to be fucked over?
They don't have a choice. The box office in North America, the largest movie market in the world, has been completely plateaued for the last several years. It shrunk a few percentage points last year as competition from other entertainment comes up, as people tire of sequel after sequel of blockbuster superhero films, a lack of independent cinema reflecting other perspectives on life. So what do? They turn to, like every other industry, China, where there's a growth market in people who are interested in things that are entertaining. And so it's a huge part of the government's push to drive the Chinese government's push to drive consumerism. Because if you think about it, the people who can afford a 180 yuan ticket to a 3D IMAX film in a second tier city are also the people who are going to go into a shopping mall, of which the cineplexes and the multiplexes are an anchor tenant.
Okay, this is going to, I think, be a good segue into our kind of next bit. But basically what you're saying is that Hollywood knows it's going to be fucked over, but it won't be fucked over too much. They'll still be able to grow. So they see the growth potential, and they're prepared to deal with the fact that they are going to be messed around with.
Let's go back to Los Angeles in February. The Motion Picture Association and Biden touted this as a big win for Hollywood because it's a greater percentage of the gross than they had before and more films that are coming in. Now, it might be a little too little, a little too late, but it is certainly more than they had before. The question now is, how will those release dates be managed?
How much more, really, is the question.
Yeah.
So one stunt that Hollywood has been trying is the China-U.S. co-productions. Hollywood movies where there's sort of a, in many cases, what looks like a fig leaf Chinese participation in the production. They shoot some in studios here, or they sort of drop in a random Chinese character or a subplot. It qualifies as a co-production, and co-productions are apparently exempt from some of the import restrictions. What is happening with those?
Indeed, that is a strategy that some of the studios have pursued. One after another has tried it. Warner Brothers some time ago got into the business of co-producing films with the China Film Group. Their joint venture came up and disappeared in about 3 years. It may still exist, but not in any sort of open and productive way. Most recently, we've seen DreamWorks Animation, as was announced in February, say that it's going to work with three state-run entities, investment entities, to co-produce films for the world, but partly in China. Now, most of those will be animated films.
Jonathan, let's just get on. Okay, I think there are two deals that are maybe we should now get into the nitty-gritty of. Deal number one is what you just mentioned, right? Oriental DreamWorks.
That's right.
And then if I may speculate a guess as to deal number two, it would be Wanda, which is one of China's biggest real estate companies. It's a property company, right?
Property company founded in Dalian. Its CEO.
Founded in Dalian?
Yeah.
During Dalian, the tenure of Bo Xilai.
Indeed, it was. Dalian Wanda
Interesting
Group,
little footnote.
Very much, and watched very closely, in fact, by the people who watch Mr. Wang. Wang Jianlin, the CEO of Wanda, was in the United States last week closing his purchase of AMC. And AMC is the second largest movie theater owner in the United States, the largest movie market in the world. And Wanda purchased outright for a heck of a lot of money, more in fact than people felt AMC was valued at, and has become the largest cinema owner in the world overnight. Nobody outside China anyway knew who Wang Jianlin was, and he was at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard last weekend talking about his strategy.
Outside of a small circle of people who follow these things, I would imagine the average person, the American Lao Bai Xing, common person, does not know that the theater they are going to watch a movie at tonight is owned by
Well, he has been all over the front pages of the business pages of the biggest newspapers in America for the last month or so since they announced the deal. So all of a sudden, anyone who's got even the most remote China business interest knows who the heck he is.
Do people care in the U.S.?
Well,
are they worried that all of those propaganda epics are going to start parachuting into their neighborhood AMC theaters?
I, for one, am not, because I think that...
yes, but you live here. You're already, you know, you've been...
Well, no, but I mean, so far as, I mean, certainly that question was asked. Are we going to see the founding of the Republic being distributed to AMCs in Akron, Ohio, or in Kansas City?
And one can't imagine so, because surely, I mean, Mr. Wang is a businessman and
indeed.
And knows already that nobody...
He knows he's going to do better with the Avengers. He's figured that out.
Well, look, the exhibitors with whom he works in theaters all across China know that, and that's why they have been importing and dying to get Hollywood product, because at this stage, the Chinese films that are being made for much more modest budgets than Hollywood spends, just don't have the bells and whistles and the flash that Hollywood does, and you know Chinese consumers are addicted to Hollywood.
Okay, so now basically a Chinese company is in control of most of the movie theaters in America, but they probably won't change anything because they know what the smell of money is like, and
the average
smells
American,
better than the founding of a republic.
There's a big obvious issue, which is that the average American moviegoer seldom sees a film that's subtitled.
And won't do it because...
The animation may lead the way because you can make an animated film, and this ties into the DreamWorks deal.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to work. I mean, do you remember Clarissa Ward, ABC correspondent, used to be in Beijing, a fantastic TV journalist, a glamorous blonde woman who can speak with perfect American or perfect British. You know, it depends on who she's talking to or what mood she's in or... When she is on American TV, it has to be an American accent. You know, this is not even talking about a foreign language. This is just, an accent.
Mm.
So, I mean, is it at all likely that the American Lao Bai Sing, the great unwashed masses country, will ever want to watch subtitled films?
Well, no. Listen, let's back up and look at animation. I mean, the other deal we're talking about here is DreamWorks. DreamWorks made Kung Fu Panda. Kung Fu Panda was an enormous hit. In fact, Kung Fu Panda 2 sold more tickets in China than it did in the United States.
So if this new DreamWorks operation, which have we mentioned, maybe is the third deal we should have mentioned.
No, that was the first
that
one
was
you
the
mentioned.
First one. That was the first one. Sorry, I'm getting confused. The movie business.
Their first project at the big complex that they're building in Shanghai will in fact be the next iteration of Kung Fu Panda in cooperation with Chinese partners. And animation works because you can dub it. You can have a Hollywood actor be the voice, and you can have a Russian actor be the voice. So animation may yet lead the way for Chinese-made films.
So, I mean, let me open this up a little bit in terms of the prospects of Chinese movies going to the U.S. You know, when I was in my youthful Asiaphile days, I used to get the VHS redubs of the Hong Kong action movies and, you know, from the Chinese video rental in the Sunset in San Francisco and watch them until the tapes fell apart. The Hong Kong movies, which were great and had a substantial, if culty, following in the U.S. It has seemed to me that China has, as a country with a growing film industry of its own, always punched below its weight in its ability to export movies, partially because, to my eye, a lot of them aren't very good. Some of them are. And the ones that historically have been good have been sort of the ones at the margins.
Every Chinese film director spends all of their creative energies, Your creative energies are not necessary for the story or the art direction or for anything that contributes to good cinema in China. Your creative energies are necessary for finding your way around the
you're managing SARFT.
The douchebags at SAFT, which is the State Administration of Radio, Film, and Television, which censors all film, TV, and radio, if you don't know.
Indeed. Listen, there have been a few breakout films that traveled to the States. Zhang Yimou's Hero, Ang Lee's Now, whether or not it's traveling for Ang Lee, but it was a Chinese language film, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Not really a Chinese production.
No, indeed. There was plenty of Chinese involvement, however. But, you know, that was a multi-country co-production. Nevertheless, those films have been held up as the example, at least in terms of the minds of the Hollywood folk hoping to work with China.
I thought Hero was spectacularly tedious. Just saying.
Indeed. You're not alone there. Listen, those films, which did so well in the United States for Chinese language films, despite their being subtitled, have been held up as the example of the sorts of films that Hollywood like to try to get into doing. But the Chinese public has moved on.
But then, those are cliches. I mean, those are sort of people flying around with swords. You know, these are
it's safe territory.
Where is the great modern Chinese?
Well, that's
the contemporary Chinese film.
That's a big problem.
Yeah, whatever. Let's talk about business.
This is the soft power issue.
But before we get onto that, I think we should end up our discussion on this topic with the soft power issue. Before we get to that, let's keep it. We're all more or less Americans. Let's talk about business. So Wanda now owns basically the theater in the United States. What do they do in China? Are they in a similar business in China?
Oh, they do all sorts of real estate development. And so they're building, basically shopping malls. And one of the anchor tenants in every shopping mall is now a multiplex. It takes out a huge portion of the overhead, pays rent, it's a long-term lease. And then again, also helps push consumerism. So again, it brings us back to the government's macroeconomic plan to move the economy away from manufacturing toward consumerism. Movies are a key piece to that puzzle.
There's a Wanda cinema around the corner from my house in the Wanda Guangtang on Jianguo Road. It's great. It's spectacular.
Is it busy?
Yes.
It's full?
It's full of people. The auditoriums are crowded. The screens are nice. The sound is good. The seats are comfortable. It's not cheap, but it's a very nice cinema.
Okay. So here's a question, and it's partly coming out. I should explain the background of asking this question. Part of me really hates the film business. And, part of me thinks that the greatest thing Chairman Mao ever said was Pao Da Siling Bu, bombard the headquarters. And part of me thinks that the internet is going to destroy the film business because, number one, nobody wants to go to a mall because you can get everything you want on 360 buy. Everything. Everything. I mean, you can buy a fucking elephant on the internet now. And you can watch whatever you want on the internet.
Two-day delivery.
No. 360 buy. You order before 10:30 a.m. It's same-day delivery. So part of me welcomes this development that the entire traditional business structure hasn't quite realized how it's going to implode because nobody's going to want to go to malls. And maybe I'm overstating the case. Am I overstating the case? Will e-commerce, the ability to watch films that you download and the ability to never have to actually go to a mall anymore, which you really don't. You really don't anymore in China.
Yeah, I would tend to disagree.
Is that
there
going to impact Wanda's plans for this great retail mall movie expansion?
Not in the short term, no. Because, there are cities of more than a million people, and lots of them here in China, which are just now getting their first multiplex. And the satellite cities to those small but not so small cities don't have any movie theater. And if all of a sudden an entire village takes a bus into the new multiplex in a third tier city and watches for the first time a film broadcast on an IMAX screen in 3D, they're on drugs. It's just like nothing they've ever seen, and it's better than a pirated DVD.
That's the thing. Yeah. I think that's the thing. What they've done, particularly because they've built nice cinemas, and they're doing IMAX, and they're doing 3D, and the tickets are expensive, is that they've turned the movies into a positional good.
So it's like Starbucks. Chinese people never, even now, don't necessarily have like a real coffee, like jonesing for a cup of coffee.
Well, what's going to impress
you? But they're going to go to Starbucks because it's a nice environment, and you can bring a girl or a colleague.
Right, what's going to impress your best girl, whipping out the pirate DVD and watching it on your laptop or taking her to the multiplex?
Right.
Exactly. And you can group buy those tickets so they're not always so expensive. Tuesdays are often half-price days.
You are bullish on the cinema, the theater expansion
on the short term. I mean, it's obviously the real estate development issue is a much bigger one. And whether the anchor tenant of a multiplex is enough to sustain an entire shopping mall, I would doubt. But on the short term, there are still people who are very hungry to experience the movies writ large. It is like 1930s America.
Or maybe 1990s when Nirvana had that song, Entertain Us, right? That's what Chinese people need, entertainment. And it's still sadly lacking. Well, TV sucks.
That's the other thing, too. I mean, your options on legal TV, at any rate, are pretty dismal.
Boring, and, yeah.
You know, my anecdotal evidence is slim. I only ever go to two movie theaters here, the Wanda around the corner, and I go to the Megabox at Sanlitun Village. They're both jam-packed every time I go to them. Jam-packed.
Meanwhile, the other end of the spectrum, there are independent filmmakers who, you know, can't find financing to make their films. And these are people who are telling stories that would never get past the censors in the first place. But, you know, 3 weeks ago, I went to the 9th annual Beijing Independent Film Festival.
Was that the one that was shut down because of a so-called power cut like half an hour after it started?
Indeed it was.
During a movie that the officials were particularly concerned about.
Right. Oh.
Well, indeed.
Sure.
Okay, so
yes.
A film called Egg and Stone, which is, you know, around the sensitive topic of incest and sexual abuse in a Chinese family, and won an award at the Rotterdam International Film Festival earlier this year, was opening the film festival. And the organizers had indeed talked with the local officials in Zhongzhuang, which is about an hour southeast of Beijing, in an artist district like 798 or Caochangdi. And they'd been sort of warned, you know, not to show these films of these certain subjects in public. And they went ahead with it anyway, because these guys, this is what they do. They're filmmakers. They're completely driven to do this, and they do it on a shoestring budget. Well, indeed, a few minutes into the film, the audience of about 500 people were in the dark. The lights went out. They poured out into the sunshine. It was an afternoon screening. And the officials swarmed around. They apologized. There were a lot of plainclothes police reported to have been there. I wasn't there that day, but a lot of witnesses. Very frustrating.
Beijing's current city motto? Do you know it? It's like all plastered all over Beijing. Any empty billboard space has this motto on right now. It's Beijing Jingshan, the Beijing spirit.
So, oh, yes.
Do you know the four characteristics of the Beijing spirit?
Patriotism.
Inclusiveness. Baorong, inclusiveness. Virtue, or thick virtue, one could say, holder. And what is the fourth one? Baorong.
That was inclusiveness.
Inclusiveness, yes. Or tolerance. And then Iagor, patriotism.
So if I can just pick up and finish about the Independent Film Festival, you know, despite being shut down, what these guys do, this is run by a guy called Li Xianting, who's a longtime promoter and curator of contemporary art.
Maybe one could even emphasize a little bit. Li Xianting is the doyen and the godfather of the contemporary art scene. He's the person who nurtured every single famous contemporary Chinese artist, basically.
So in 2006, he took his energies and that spirit of supporting people who had something to say in their own way and basically formed a film school out in Songzhuang. And he basically gets kids together and teaches them the notion that you can use a camera to tell a story your way without the state administration of radio, film, and television looking over your shoulder. So they come in, the local officials shut it down. What do? They show 46 or 40-plus features or 40-plus documentaries and 30 roughly feature films for the next 8 days in his office. They just transform his office into a screening room, and there's a really lively crowd of filmmakers, film fans, programmers from international film festivals who travel from all over the world to come to this festival. And they sit down and they basically figure out, all right, who are the next talented independent voices in Chinese film? And this happens completely, you know, independent of this big commercial boom. But there are, you know, directors a generation up, people like Jia Zhangke, who started in that position and then chose, perhaps as he aged, perhaps as he tired of dealing with SARFT and all of the restrictions, chose to try to work within the system. So, and, you know, Li Xianting respectfully says, all right, to each his own. You will take your film. You'll figure out how to get it out. And it must be very difficult for independent filmmakers not to want to try to get out to the Chinese audience through this incredible infrastructure that has just been built up. And they're sort of scared about the Hollywood films that are shrinking their space on their own screens.
Well, you got into it there at the end, but it just you know, it seems to me that the great tragedy of this is that all this interesting stuff that's sort of bubbling around at the margins of the industry, you know, foreigners will get to see some of it on the film festival circuit. Some of it will get international distribution. But Chinese authorities have not been shy about going to foreign film festivals and warning them off of things they think are particularly sensitive, which is another soft power own goal. But, you know, it's a tragedy for Chinese viewers that they don't get to see this stuff. They don't get to see it in cinemas anyway. Some of it might filter back on DVDs, but...
not DVDs. Jonathan, it's all on the internet.
Yeah. Jonathan, do you know anything about the recent rumor that Saft might be subsumed into the Ministry of Culture? I, for one, don't believe it for a second, because the Ministry of Culture is probably the weakest ministry. But there were some rumors floating around online in the last couple of weeks. Have you heard anything about that?
I can't say that I have, but that also seems a rather unlikely turn of events to me. I mean, Sarft has power over not only film, mind you, but television. And television is a much more tightly controlled medium.
Television, radio.
Yeah. Yeah.
And working very hard to extend their mandate over parts of the internet as well.
Oh, and they already have succeeded. I mean, there's been a turf war going on for many years. And Saft has increasingly been staking claim to being able to be the regulator of any kind of online moving image. Mm. And
well, let's look back at February and Xi Jinping's visit to Los Angeles. You know, Xi Jinping is a purported fan of Hollywood films. In one of the WikiLeaks that came out of former Ambassador Clark Rant's memos back to the United States, he recorded a conversation, and I'm paraphrasing here, which told people back in the State Department in Washington that this fellow, who was the presumptive next leader of China, was telling him how much he loved films like Saving Private Ryan and how wonderful Hollywood directors had it because they could talk about right versus wrong. So is Xi Jinping a Hollywood film fan? We don't know, but it was the first time that a senior Chinese leader and the word Hollywood appeared in the same sentence anywhere.
On the other hand, Kim Jong-il was reputedly a huge Hollywood film fan. That didn't mean much for the viewing opportunities of the North Korean people.
Indeed. He actually invented cinema, don't you realize?
That's right. I'd read
that. Yeah. Yeah.
Amongst many other things.
Many other things, yeah.
Okay. So where are we here? So is Hollywood going to make money? Is Hollywood going to make bank in China?
Hollywood is making bank in China more than they were before. It will not be easy. There's no question about it. The rules change every 3 to 6 months. Increasingly, their studios are hiring people who have now, you know, a decade of experience trying to watch this relationship grow. Local Chinese who have themselves developed a taste for Hollywood and its product and want it to succeed because they believe that the trickle down of talent and process that Hollywood brings to China and its filmmakers will improve the local industry.
Is there any sign that the State Administration of Radio, Film, and Television and the Communist Party's Propaganda Department and the State Council Information Office and the various other bodies that have the say over what goes into onto the Chinese silver screen, is there any sign that the uptight, out-of-touch, conservative old farts who make the decisions may have twigged onto the fact that their taste sucks?
You can look at it two ways. Sure. I mean, there were not films that had the sort of violence and action and even fantastical characters we are so used to in Western films. Monsters, not so many here yet, but...
a topic dear to my heart,
They're coming, yes. Will wrote a fabulous essay a couple of weeks ago on his blog about the absence of Godzilla-like films in China. Part of the reason is that you can't have monsters destroying Chinese landmarks.
So is that changing? No-no. I mean, is there any
that,
sign
that of part of it is not changing. But if you consider that, you know, the whole genre of romantic comedies didn't exist to the degree that it does now, and there's your contemporary story. That's a safe topic. If you have modern sort of ladder-climbing office girl romance with the boss, there are plenty of films like that that have come up and done quite well here.
And yet the range of topics that an American would consider the grist of popular filmmaking that remains off limits here is still pretty long. I mean, you don't, you know, the
pretty, I think, yeah, is extensive. Somewhat understatement.
It's extensive. It's encyclopedic. You know, things about the government, police, you know, the stuff that drives every spy thriller and action movie.
But let's end off with a summary of your blog post about Godzilla and China.
My point, speaking as somebody who grew up watching lots of Godzilla movies, was that it had struck me that I could find no record of a Chinese monster movie. And when I thought about it, it became clear to me that the reason why this was, aside from the normal concerns about sort of superstitious or monstrous things, was that that genre doesn't work because, as Jonathan said, it requires you to depict the destruction of cities, particularly landmarks. If you look at Godzilla movies in Japan, Tokyo, the capital, and famous landmarks get smashed because people recognize them. They want to see recognizable things fall underneath, you know, giant latex monsters. You can't do it here. It's unacceptable. It's not – it would never be allowed. It's that imagery is not acceptable. It's simply beyond the pale. It sends a message that the government here won't countenance. So you lose that whole genre, despite the fact that it is so on the face of it preposterous, ridiculous, and harmless. So this was my thesis, was that that's why you don't have rubber suit monster movies here, and that, speaking as the parent of a small boy, it is a great tragedy.
There's another funny thing about that, or perhaps not so funny, is that just imagine a giant Chinese monster, as your essay suggests, you know, smashing the Rem Koolhaas-designed CCTV building, the cantilevered structure on the East Third Ring Road.
Throwing it onto the Forbidden City. What a sight.
And then take it a step further and imagine, is there a Chinese superhero who might come in and save the city from that monster? Well, that can't happen either, because the notion of a superhero implies that the state and its apparatus, the police, are ineffective. So you can't have a superhero movie either.
So here's how that movie works. The monster waddles out of the ocean somewhere around Tianjin, and the PLA stops it on the beach. End of story. Roll credits.
Boring.
Yes, that's the problem.
Oh, God. All right. Enough of the movie business.
But then maybe you could turn it into a romantic comedy, which would be politically acceptable.
So it's kind of like Godzilla meets Xiao Wang.
Exactly. And this is why
they get married and become a Xiao Kang Jiating, and they have one kid and a small apartment outside
exactly.
the Sixth Ring Road
of
Beijing.
And they would complain about the housing prices, but that's off limits too. Yeah. So, and this is why I don't watch Chinese movies much anymore, except for the propaganda epics, which I watch because I'm a propaganda fetishist. So I like a certain kind of punishment. But to me, it's a great loss for popular culture here.
It is a great loss for popular culture. I think it's one of the tragedies. And the people who are currently in charge of cultural and media policy will have some very, very bad karma.
And it's a loss for soft power, too, because film, as Americans in Hollywood know, film is great soft power. And even if Americans don't watch films with subtitles, plenty of other people do. Europeans do, Asians do, the Koreans are exporting movies. Hong Kong, now part of China, is exporting movies. Japan has exported movies and popular culture for decades. It can be done. And yet it doesn't happen here, I think, to the level that it should.
Sure. Let me just mention one more deal, which is pertinent to this little
thread of
discussion.
Let's make this the last comment because we're running over time.
Well, one of the other deals that came up in the spring was the announcement by Disney subsidiary Marvel Comics, the creator of wonderful superheroes that we all know and love, would be doing a deal with a Beijing-based company called DMG Entertainment. And DMG is known for 18 years as a leader in advertising on television and also was one of the participants in the founding of the party and the founding of the Republic Films.
And one of the very, very few foreign-controlled companies that has made any real inroads. Right,
well, it's not
industry,
a foreign-controlled company.
It's
they
not.
Happen to have a CEO who's an American, Dan Mintz, who speaks wicked Chinese and is very, you know, well-known in the Chinese film industry. So, you know, he and his partners, Chinese partners, made their money helping Nike and the NBA brand themselves on television. What they did was essentially go into partnership with Marvel Comics or Marvel Entertainment, part of Disney, to allegedly co-produce Iron Man 3. But as quickly came out when the director of that film, the American director of that film, so indiscreetly made the announcement at Comic-Con that actually there would be very little of the film shot in China at all. And so people have begun to question whether it will be a co-production, thus allowing it automatic distribution in China. Let's also remember that if anyone knows anything about Iron Man, his nemesis from the comics, from back when you actually picked up the comics at a comic book shop, was a guy called the Mandarin. And, that's
still in the story, right?
Absolutely not.
Not in.
They removed it now.
They're smart enough to know he can't go into any of their movies in the country that took the Chinese restaurant scene out of Men in Black 3.
No, right. Not even close. So there is indeed a relatively well-known Chinese actor who's been cast as a scientist who will help Iron Man.
I'm heading to the movie theater right after this.
All right. Enough of this nonsense. Let's move on to recommendations. Will, what you got for us?
I have a twofold recommendation. So the first thing is this movie is a couple of years old. And in fact, Jeremy, you have written about it on Danway previously. It's the documentary Last Train Home by Fan Li Xin, which I just saw for the first time this week. And I thought was very, very interesting. It's not actually a Chinese film. It's really a Canadian film with an expatriate Chinese director who lives in Canada. But it's very interesting to me because, you know, it's about migrant workers and it's about the Chunyun going home for the Spring Festival and what an ordeal that is, as well as their lives in general and the family tensions. And I thought it was very, very interesting. The centerpiece is really the sort of great meltdown at the Guangzhou train station in 2008 when there was this snowstorm in the south. And you know, it's very interesting just because although it's not a perfect film, it sort of hints at the kind of stories there are to be told here out of Chinese culture and society and the things that I think could be done more regularly and more widely by the domestic film industry if it was allowed to do so. Anyway, I thought it was a very interesting film and you can get it on iTunes or you can get it through your sort of usual distribution mechanisms and worth a watch. And the second recommendation that I had just for people who think that the United States has been immune to censorship or government interference in the movies, head over to Wikipedia's page on the Motion Picture Production Code and read about the rules by which Hollywood lived its life by for several decades before it liberalized, really, I guess, in the 60s. We'll put a link to it up on the podcast page. But it makes for interesting reading. And for those of us who grew up in that more liberal era and watched our formative movies in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you know, things were not always so free and easy for mass market films in the United States.
All right. Jonathan, as you know by now, it's our regular feature, the recommendations. So anything, preferably China-related, what you got?
A quick note tagging on to what Will just said about the motion picture code. China has no film rating system, and that is basically carte blanche for SARFT to censor anything because there are no rules that say this is an R-rated film, this is a PG-rated film. Just a note. My recommendation that's just come to me is a film that I saw at the Beijing Independent Film Festival a couple of weeks ago.
In Li Xianting's office.
In Li Xianting's office.
Way to go, China.
Yeah, anyway, and it's by a 27-year-old third-time filmmaker who is a fine arts graduate who basically took a tripod and an HD video camera and as a part of a collective of filmmakers at Cao Changdi, run by Wu Wenguang, who is a well-known documentary filmmaker from the early 90s, participated in something called the Folk Memory Project. And so he tasked Zhou Suiping, that's the name of the young filmmaker whose film I saw, to take her camera and go back to her ancestral village in Shandong and record the stories of the elders in the village of how they survived the great famines of 58, 59, 60, 61. And these are grizzled peasants, many of them toothless, who still, you know, carry big loads on their back at age 80, have never certainly been to the movies, didn't quite understand what she was doing when she was recording their stories. So I saw the second of her films. The first one was called The Starving Village, which was her recording these stories. The second one begins with her walking around the village, a very dusty old place with, you know, outhouses, occasional running water, you know, scraggly dogs running about. It is very much sort of from another century And she's running about trying to convince these very people whose stories she's recorded to come and see the film. And so this film is called The Satiated Village, and it is her recording of their reactions to her first film. And they are all remarkable. They sort of it dawns on them that they're actually now on the screen in this film. So she's captured both the storytelling and then the reaction to the storytelling. And the reaction was fascinating. Half of them, I would say, instantly said, this is an insult to Chairman Mao's memory. And the other half said, you go, girl, tell this story to the world.
Where can one see this film?
It will be playing at a film festival in France, and I'm afraid I don't remember which one. Not
but
one of
no
the bigger
online,
ones.
But no online, because the film business hates the internet.
If you connect with Li Xianting's film fund out in Songjiang, I'm certain that you can.
One could find it
right. Through them. She is with Wu Wangguang's documentary collective in Taoshangdi. You know, these guys are absolutely diehard. They will do this. When I was interviewing him for the International Herald Tribune, the phrase he said with a smile was one of the favorites of Mao in trying to foment revolution, which was, you know, a spark can start a prairie fire.
Okay. My recommendation is a book, Chinese Characters, Profiles of Fast-Changing Lives in a Fast-Changing Land, which last night I had the pleasure to moderate a discussion with two of the contributors, Ian Johnson and Christina Larson, who's been a guest on the show. It's a book with a bunch of different stories about individual Chinese people, with a very big range of writers, ranging from young up-and-coming writer Alec Ash to Pulitzer Prize-winning Ian Johnson, put together by Jeff Wasserstrom, who's also been on the show, and Anjali Shah. Anyway, Chinese Characters, good book. And on that note, gentlemen, I think we've run a little over time.
Kaiser's going to come back from Tianjin angry now.
He's going to come back pissed, but we may already have executed the sale of this podcast to one of our potential investors, and Kaiser may not have any say in it. And on that note, I bid you two gentlemen good night, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for having us.